comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 4th, in Room 100 of Noyes Laboratory of Chemistry, 505 South Matthews, Urbana, the Geological Survey is presenting a public seminar titled Energy in the 21st Century. The markets are here, but the resources are there. The speakers are Drs. Robert G. Skinner, former director of the Policy Office of the International Energy Agency in Paris, and Robert J. Finley of the ISGS. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where U of I theater students present the award-winning play Intimate Apparel, and dance students entertain with wide-ranging movement language in Studio Dance 2. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Just a little more than 2 weeks to go now before tax returns need to be on their way to the IRS and the Illinois Department of Revenue. So two tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated are with us this afternoon. Our guests are Marty Verdick and John Breen. They're here to answer your tax questions. So if you need a little help putting things in order and filling in those returns, you can give us a call this afternoon. Talk to John and Marty, and they'll do their best to give you a hand. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Marty Verdick is a CPA and Managing Director of Tax Services of RSM McGladrey Incorporated, and John Breen is a manager in the Tax Department of RSM McGladrey. They join us a couple of times a year to answer tax questions, and I'm pleased to have them back here with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Good to see you guys. Well, you know, I was going to say just a little more than 2 weeks to go before tax returns need to be in the mail. We don't necessarily have to send them in by mail anymore.
No. In fact, we're seeing quite an increase in electronic filing. And I would estimate that probably half of the individual returns that we're doing now are electronically filed. It used to be that returns that had certain types of schedules and attachments, you couldn't electronically file. It had to be only the simplest of returns. But that's changing. And now almost every return would be eligible for electronic filing. And there are a lot of advantages for it. Number one is that you get electronic confirmation that the IRS actually got the return. So you don't have to worry about things getting lost in the mail. If you have a refund coming, certainly it gets you your money much faster, probably, generally 10 to 14 days from the time that the return is transmitted. Could be as little as 7 or 8 days from the time the return is transmitted until you get the money. So there are a lot of reasons why people are doing it. And, in fact, you can even electronically file extensions if, by chance, you can't have the tax return done by the due date.
Okay. What is the latest on extensions now?
Okay. It used to be that an extension was good for a four-month period, and if you needed an additional 60 days, there was a second form that you had to send in along with a reason why you needed the additional extension. Well, I have never seen the IRS deny the second extension, regardless of the reason, and apparently they decided that they were wasting time by doing that, so they'd never changed the extension so that the automatic extension is a six-month extension. You don't need a reason. You just need to send the extension in. Now, it is an extension of time to file the return. It is not an extension of time to pay the tax. So if you have tax due, you still need to pay the tax by April 17th this year, since the 15th falls on Saturday. You have until Monday, the 17th of April. And that extension, which does need to be filed by the 17th, would give you an extension of up to 6 months to file the return. But any tax due does need to be filed by April 15th. If you don't pay an appropriate amount of tax by that date, you will be subject to penalties and interest.
Okay, so in essence, you've really got to figure out how much tax you owe if you owe tax and figure that out and pay it.
Right.
That along with the extension.
Yes. Now, many people consistently get refunds from year to year, and so they make the assumption that they're going to get a refund again, so they just send an extension in with no balance due. That's fine, but if you anticipate having a refund, why would you want to leave your money sitting at the government any longer than you have to? It's basically an interest-free loan, so you might as well get the return done and get it back.
I suppose, though, there are circumstances where you find yourself in, you know, an emergency situation or something, or there's extenuating circumstances
that
you just can't deal with that right now.
And in fact, in some cases, it's because information, as an example, partnerships aren't required to file their returns until April 15th as well. And if you're a partner in a partnership, you might not get the K-1 for that partnership until the very last minute, and it's just not possible to get your return done on time.
Okay.
So there are reasons why people do have to file an extension.
Okay. Marty Verdick and John Breen are with us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine to take your questions about filing that tax return. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's take our first call. Listener in Sycamore on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I have received or purchased for the first time a bank CD that was in the aftermarket and had a small amount of accrued interest that I had to pay the previous owner of that CD.
Right.
And I did not have that money deducted when my 1099 came in January.
Correct. For example, when the 1099 came in, let's assume that it showed that you earned $100 of interest, which was the total amount of interest on the CD. But in fact, when you bought the CD in the secondary market, you paid someone else $10 for the accrued interest which had occurred up to the date of purchase. Is that your situation?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. What you would do on your tax return on Schedule B is report the amount shown on the 1099, the $100, as interest income identified by the bank, and then add another line and put a description such as less accrued interest purchased and put in a negative $10 so that you net to the $90 that you actually are taxable on.
Ah, thank you very much. That's exactly the dilemma I was having.
Yeah. Yeah, if you by doing it that way, the IRS will be able to match up the 1099 and see that you're reporting the income. This happens quite often in the tax-exempt bond area, not so much in the taxable world, but it does happen.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment. So if you give us a call right now, we'll get you right into our two tax experts this afternoon, John and Marty. Let's talk a little bit about the tax credit for hybrid cars. Now, as I understand it, it went up on the 1st of January thanks to the Energy Policy Act of 2005. But I've also read that not everyone who buys such an automobile may be eligible for the credit. So a couple questions here. What's the credit as of January 1st? What if you bought the car last year? And who's eligible and who's not?
Well, and that's an interesting point, especially regarding if you purchased that car in 2005, because I've had several clients already this year who have come in expecting to get a credit, and they don't get one. There was a deduction that you were allowed in years prior to 06. So if you purchased that vehicle sometime in 05, then it's a $2,000 deduction that you get on your tax return, not a credit. So the deduction basically comes off of your income before you figure your tax. Now, had this person waited until January 1st, 2006 to buy the vehicle, then they would have been eligible for a credit, and a credit is a dollar-for-dollar reduction of your tax. So it's a big, big difference, and I've had several surprised people when we've had that discussion. As far as how much do you get, it really depends on the vehicle. It depends on the type of gas mileage that it's going to get, and I'm sure that there's a formula that the IRS uses to determine what that is. And I think the last time that Marty and I were here, we did have this question come up, and I think our response then was ask your salesperson because it will very likely be listed right on the sticker of the car.
In order to be eligible for the credit, the vehicle has to be certified by the IRS as among the list of eligible vehicles.
Uh-huh.
And the IRS does publish that list. But the people who are going to be pushing this the hardest would be the salespeople. If the car is eligible for the credit, they're going to know because it's a sales tool.
Right.
Yeah. But right. there is a big difference, as John pointed out, between a credit and a deduction.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't stop to think about that, but yeah, that's a big difference.
It could be, depending upon a person's tax bracket and their particular situation, it could be a very substantial difference.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener now in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Could you talk about the energy savings? You know, credits or deductions for things that you do to your house or for a rental property?
Sure, sure. In fact, John will take that. We talked about that a little bit before, and he has read through that provision. It is effective in 2006. So if you've done the work in 2005, there's not going to be a credit available. So we're talking about 2006 forward. And John, you want to address that?
Sure. Well, as far as the rental property goes, the credit is not available for rental property. It is only available for your actual home, and it's for things like solar-powered systems, solar-powered water heaters. But interestingly, those water heaters cannot be used for pools or hot tubs. It must be used for showers or sinks. So they're trying to make this
energy efficient.
Well, energy efficient and for things that everyone would be using. There also is a credit available for windows, and there are some limitations on those things. So it really kind of depends on what you're doing to your home as far as the amount of the credit that you're going to be eligible for.
What about things like energy-efficient furnace, John, or if you add insulation to the house?
Yep.
Insulation is something that many people are doing again.
And yes, those all would qualify. The one thing to point out, though, is if you spend $20,000 on your improvements, don't expect to get a credit that's based on $20,000. There are going to be limitations here, and the credit may only be $500 as a maximum. So it's one of those things to kind of keep in mind. But yes, new furnaces, I believe there are certain kinds that will qualify. And again, that will be, if you talk to your salesman, they're going to know which ones are eligible for this credit.
Although I understand, though, that there might be some folks who might misunderstand the credit or misrepresent the credit, so the buyer should probably
absolutely
beware.
It is a little dangerous to get your tax advice from the salesperson at the furnace store, for example, but in terms of what level of energy efficiency and so on, it is important that each taxpayer do a little due diligence and make sure they look into it. If they're buying an item dependent upon the availability of the credit, then they need to independently verify that that credit is really going to be available for them.
Yeah. And John,
do you have a reference that's easy for the average person to understand where you could check on the details?
I'm trying to think if there's an IRS publication. I can't think of one. I'm certain that the U.S. government website would have a reference to that. I don't have a particular website reference that's going to get you to that page. But if you go to the general IRS, is it irs.gov?
irs.gov. And you can also search in there. So if you went to the irs.gov website and you click on forms and publications, you can go in and search for energy credit, and it will bring back several different listings that you can go to look at that information.
It's really too bad that there aren't credits for rental properties, because renters really don't have any way of saving money this way. So, and there are a lot of people who rent.
Yep.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. And if the idea is to encourage
energy
savings,
rental properties use energy just like your principal residence.
They sure do. Yeah. They sure do. In this Energy Policy Act of 2005, are there things that are taking effect immediately? We talked about the hybrid cars that kicked in January 1st. But are there other things that are phase-ins, or is it all up and running?
Right now our world sort of focuses on the 2005 tax filing season, and I haven't spent a lot of time looking at the credits that are going to go into effect for 2006 yet. That's kind of after April 15th thing that I'm going to look at.
Yeah. And again, our thanks for you guys for coming in this afternoon in the silly season. This is the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guests this afternoon are from RSM McGladrey Incorporated, Marty Verdick and John Breen. And we're happy to take your questions about taxes this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-2000. 9455. Let's talk with another caller. Listener in Champaign, line 2. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I got a question for the accountants.
Okay.
It's a real estate question regarding an LLC.
Mm-hmm. Is it is this a single member or a multiple member LLC?
Well, it could be structured either way.
Okay.
The problem I'm running into is I've read where if you put real estate, rental real estate, into a LLC, that LLCs are treated by the IRS like limited partnerships.
Well, that's actually the question that I started as far as single or multiple member. If this is a single member LLC, you are the sole owner of the limited liability company,
Okay. Then
it is known as a disregarded entity.
Understand that. Okay. So let's say it's multi-member.
Then it is treated as a partnership.
Okay.
And you would have to file a federal Form 1065 partnership tax return, and it is a close analogy would be a limited partnership.
I understand. My question is that what I've read is that you're treated like a limited partner, and therefore any pass-through losses through your K-1 you cannot write off on your personal tax return.
Okay.
Because you can't be an active member in an LLC because you're treated as a limited partner.
Okay. You're actually now getting into a discussion of what's known as the passive loss rules, Section 469 of the code, and it is possible you can have a limited liability company. Well, let me back up. The passive loss rules say that real estate is passive. Real estate rental activities are passive by definition, and therefore your losses may be limited. That's true whether it's a general partnership or a limited partnership.
They're limited to $25,000.
Now you're talking about the actively managed rental real estate provision.
But if you pass that through your LLC, I mean, if you've got $25,000 in losses outside the LLC because of your rental real estate,
mm-hmm.
and you take those properties and put them into an LLC, as what I'm reading is, says that now you can no longer pass those losses through on the K-1 and take them on your 1040 because limited partners can't do that.
Well, they certainly would. It would appear on the K-1. It would flow out to you as an individual. The question then that you're posing is the fact that it is in a multiple member LLC, could you qualify for the actively managed rental real estate exception, the $25,000 exception? And I believe your analysis is correct. A limited partner, by definition, would not be considered an active real estate participant, and that could be an issue. Now, I mean, the simple way to solve that is simply have use a single member LLC. But if you've got multiple members, that can be an issue.
Well, let me ask you this then, because in further research on this, I'm trying to figure out how to be able to use LLCs, multiple member LLCs, and still get the tax benefit. Somewhere I read that if you do not designate any of the members as
managing members,
no managers, the IRS considers them all managers, and therefore they are like a general partnership, and therefore you can get the loss.
From a general partnership from a management standpoint, yes, not from a liability standpoint. You would still have the limited liability available to an LLC owner.
Yeah, so that's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yes, you can get there.
And that would work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay. Good luck. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I've got a call coming in on the toll-free line at the moment. So let me reintroduce our guest this afternoon. Marty Verdick is a CPA and Managing Director of Tax Services for RSM McGladrey Incorporated. And John Breen is a manager in the Tax Department of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Next, we go to Bloomington, Illinois. A listener on line 4. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, very good. I have a question for the guest.
Okay.
Yeah, the question that I wanted to ask is, if you live with your spouse for 11 months out of the year, and she moves out, and then before you file jointly, but now you're having to file separately. There's no any court order for or divorce papers. You just separated. Can you file as a head of household?
Okay. I'm going to repeat what I believe your question is just to make sure. You are still married as of the last day of the year.
That's correct.
Okay. There has been no, but you are separated. And at that point, your choices for filing your tax return are going to be married filing jointly, and you are still allowed to do that, even though you're not living together, assuming that both spouses can agree to file a tax return together. And I would suggest that in many cases that is to your advantage if you can do that.
Okay.
If you cannot, if a spouse has left and you are not able to file a joint tax return, then your only other choice is a married filing separate tax return. Is that
okay?
Now, your question then is, if you meet the other eligibility requirements for head of household status, in other words, you're maintaining a household for a dependent child, can you use that status in lieu of the married filing separately status? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. I believe the answer to that is no, but I have not had that question come up lately. John is flipping the pages here trying to confirm that answer. But I believe that head of household status, I believe that's reserved for a single taxpayer that meets the other qualifications.
Okay.
We'll tell you what we'll do is we'll look as we're doing the show here, and if we find the answer to that, why we'll get that to you.
Okay.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
All right, you're welcome.
So stay tuned,
Thank you.
We'll see if we can come up with that answer. In the meantime,
good question.
Yeah. In the meantime, let's take another call. Listener in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hola.
Hi.
Let's discuss what do they mean by bona fide foreign residents. The, you know, other test of a foreign residence, something like 330 days, is pretty clear. But what's the first one? And also discuss retirement plans and foreign income exclusion. Grazie.
Okay. And I believe the caller is hung up, so it'll be difficult to get clarification. What he's referring to is there is a provision for the exclusion of income earned while outside the United States. And you need to meet one of two tests in order to exclude income. One is the 330-day test that he referred to, which basically says that you must be physically outside the United States for 330 days out of a 365-day period. The other one is the bona fide residence test, where you've actually established a residence in a foreign country. And that would generally mean that you've surrendered, you no longer maintain a residence in the United States. The first test, the 330-day test, would be commonly used for someone who is temporarily outside of the United States, such as a sabbatical would be an example, where you continue to maintain a residence in the United States. The second test would be a situation where you physically relocate. You literally no longer maintain a home here and move out of the country. He had a second question dealing with retirement plans and exclusion, and I'm afraid I'm not sure where he was going with that. So
Either do I. Maybe he can give us a call back.
Okay.
He's certainly welcome to do that. No one else is waiting for us. 333-9455. He had this question about retirement, but I'm not quite sure what he was asking. So again, he can call back if he'd like. 333-9455. And John's got an answer for us.
Yeah, I think I do.
Okay.
As I look through the regulations on this, it basically is saying that...
Now, this is for the head of household.
For head of household. Taxpayer will be considered unmarried and eligible for head of household if the spouse was not a member of the household for the last 6 months of the year and if the household is the principal place of abode of a child for whom the taxpayer would normally be entitled to claim a dependency exemption.
Okay.
So I think in our previous caller's case, the problem that he's going to have is that it was not... last 6 months of the year before the spouse moved out.
And the spouse was only gone for 1 month. Had she been gone, or he or she been gone for more than 6 months, then it's possible they would have met this test and be eligible for head of household. And just for listeners, the tax rates, I shouldn't say the rates, the tax brackets are more favorable for a head of household status when compared to a single filing status or a married filing separately status. That's why one would, if you're eligible, you would want to use head of household status.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. My husband and I have been using the same tax preparer ever since we became joint filers.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very honest relationship with this person, and I could ask him the question I'm going to ask you, but I'm too sheepish.
Okay.
I feel too awful, so I'm going to ask you.
All right.
The division of labor in our household is that I gather everything together and do all of the itemized medical and stuff.
Okay.
And even though we use a preparer who is nicely paid, this takes a long time.
Uh-huh.
Now, we're getting ready to go on a trip, and we're leaving town on the 14th of April, and we'll be gone for 2 weeks. So I'd like to think maybe I could just ask to file an extension.
Sure.
Except that we had an extension from the previous year. And I got a second extension.
Okay.
And I still have not, we have not filed our 2004 return.
Okay. And
also, we always get a refund. So it's not that we would, I'm not worried about the interest and penalty. But if push comes to shove, and I don't get everything done before the 14th,
mm-hmm.
or let's say before 1 week from now, because we need to give our preparer
sure.
time, could we file an extension for the 2005?
Sure. Sure. The fact that you haven't filed the 2004 return has no bearing on your ability to get an extension for 2005.
Okay.
So you can do that. Now, obviously, I'm sure there is a reason, and I don't need to know it, but it's odd that you wouldn't have filed your 2004 return at this point, because obviously you are now approximately 6 months past the due date.
Well, I'm a pretty good procrastinator.
Okay, well, it has the fact that you've not filed the 04 does not impact your ability to get an extension for 05.
Okay. You know, it is, as every person who has not yet filed their return knows what I mean. It is just a heck of a lot of work. You've got all these little pieces of paper and receipts, and you run around the house.
Yeah, well, welcome to our world.
We
live with this, and I understand completely. It can be challenging.
Well, it's nice for me to know that, but I still my job, and we won't have a very nice vacation because I'm supposed to get this done before we leave. But now that I know that I still could file.
Yeah, there you go. File the extension. And
if you have to, file it. Although, as a procrastinator, what that means is that in October, you're going to be facing the same thing.
Right. Well, tell me this. If I only had time to get 1 year's together, should I do the 2004 first or should I do the 2005?
It really doesn't make any difference which one you would file first. You'd need to file 04 before you file 05, because there could be some issues with 04 that would have an impact on 05.
Okay.
So you want to file them in order, but the fact that you've already extended 04 doesn't impact your ability to extend 05.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll do the 2004 one first.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. And the gentleman who called in earlier with the bona fide foreign resident
mm-hmm.
question
mm-hmm.
and the retirement and the residency issue is back on the line.
Okay.
So let's go and talk with this fellow again and get some clarification. Line 3, Champaign-Urbana. Hi.
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 Yes.
One claims the foreign income exclusion.
Uh-huh.
Can one contribute to various retirement plans, like supposedly one must have...
Oh, in other words, you have to have earned income in order to contribute to a plan.
U.S. Earned compensation. And if you're... back in the country for those 30 days and earn some of that compensation in the U.S., can it still go into a Roth or a traditional IRA? Thanks.
Okay.
Okay.
Now I have a better understanding of the question. And the question is, if you earn your money out of the United States and you exclude that money from U.S. taxation, can you then fund a retirement plan contribution based upon that foreign earned income? And this is stumped the pros this afternoon, because
that's a
question I'm not sure the answer to. And again, John is flipping through the resource material here to see if we can confirm an answer for you. But I believe certainly to the extent you have earned income back in the United States, which is not subject to the exclusion, you would be eligible for a retirement contribution based upon that that income, which is in fact taxed in the U.S. The question is, if 100% of your foreign earned income is excludable, can you make a retirement plan contribution based upon that? And that's actually a question I would normally defer to our international tax experts up in our Chicago office. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Okay. Maybe we can provide a little bit more information as we go along. John continues to
sure.
look at the code.
Yep.
Now let's take a call. Listener in Sycamore, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, hello again. I wanted also to ask a question about filing or paying quarterly mm-hmm. using the annualized installment calculator.
Sure.
Like a lot of people, I think I pay my property taxes in the second and third quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if I can, when I annualize my deductions, can I put any of that in the fourth quarter, first quarter, or do I have to wait until the second quarter and annualize it for the remaining three quarters?
You would compute it based upon the property tax deduction would be taken in the quarter that you actually paid it. So if you don't pay it until the second quarter, and that's typically the case with the first installment, when you are doing your annualized calculation, you would not include that deduction in the calculation.
Okay, but then for the second, third, and fourth quarters, I can go ahead and annualize it that way, right?
That's right. You would claim that deduction. And just for clarification for folks, there are the method that you're using, that you're suggesting, is one approach to avoiding an underpayment penalty in calculating your estimated tax. The more common approach that most people use would be to base your estimated tax payments for 2006 on your 2005 tax liability. But if you have a situation where your 2006 income is going to be less than 2005, or if it's earned in a very skewed manner toward the back end of the year, it may be advisable to do what you're suggesting, and that is calculate your taxes using this annualized method. And what it can do is result in a lower estimated tax requirement in the early quarters and back-end loading the payments, putting them in the third and fourth quarters.
Yeah, that's precisely yep. my situation, and that's what I'm attempting to do. And I do it as a test method, and whichever one results in the lower payment, of course, is the one I use.
Sure, absolutely. Yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I just have two-part question. But first one is, if you have an investment property, which is, I'm just saying, roughly, let's say, $250,000 in value,
mm-hmm.
Over the years has been fully depreciated, so there is no, mortgage and everything against it. It's fully paid for, fully depreciated, free and clear, and so on. My question to you is that in order to sell it and look for some other property or some other way to avoid a capital gain, what would be good ways of doing it? One of them, I am told, is a 1031 exchange that one can go for.
Yeah.
Other thing would be to reduce the capital gain situation would be selling on contract. Are there any other suggestions?
Okay. You've suggested two good approaches. The first, to kind of recap the question, you've got a property which is worth, let's say, $250,000 that's been fully depreciated. So if you were to sell it outright, you'd have $250,000 of gain subject to tax.
Right.
One choice, the like-kind exchange, Section 1031, allows you to, through the use of a qualified intermediary, you sell the property, the proceeds go directly to the qualified intermediary, and then you have a fixed period of time. You have 180 days for the qualified intermediary to buy the replacement property that you identify within the first 45 days of this exchange period. And then you receive the property from the qualified intermediary, and as long as you have traded up or equal in value and up or equal in equity, and in this case you have no debt on the property, you would need to buy a piece of property worth at least $250,000 and spend at least $250,000 of cash. So you could not go out and put debt on the property and put the cash in your pocket. If you do those things, then you would defer the gain and into the new property. Now, by doing that, your depreciable basis in the new property will be lower by the amount of the deferred gain. So if you buy a $300,000 replacement property and you had $250,000 of gain on the first property, the relinquished property, your depreciable basis in the new property is only going to be $50,000. You don't get to not report the gain and get to fully depreciate the new property. The second method that described is an installment sale method. And that is another method of simply deferring the recognition of the gain. It means that you are going to be receiving the proceeds from the sale of the property over a period of time, and you will recognize the gain as you receive the cash. That can work to your advantage. Depends whether or not the buyer is a good credit risk, because you are assuming a credit risk here.
Right.
It also depends on whether or not the buyer wants to do that, because in times of rising interest rates, the buyer may be interested in locking in long-term financing at the bank while interest rates are still at a relatively low level. So you may have a hard time finding a buyer that wants to do an installment purchase.
How about the situation where, let's say, since the property is getting old and all the things fully paid for, and particularly if the location is great, and let's say if you're talking about somewhere being closer to campus, which is kind of a gold mine, as we know, in town,
mm-hmm.
How about the theoretical situation of demolishing this property, going back and building, you know, high-rise, whatever the covenants and agreements call for? So let's say put $1 million investment, 8 units or whatever it calls for on that $250,000 property, which after demolition is basically the land value.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be done.
Sure, because you haven't sold the property at that point. You've simply demolished a structure which is fully depreciated,
mm-hmm.
And you have constructed a new property. So there has been no sale of the property. You haven't received any proceeds. Therefore, there's no taxable event.
So then we start all over again with $1 million property on the $200,000 lot or whatever it calls for.
Sure. If you build $1 million high-rise on that, you'd start depreciating the $1 million property, because that's your cost in the new property.
That can be done. Okay. Other quick question I have for you is that how about in a situation where, as an investor, you're buying some property, let's say some condos here and there, which is a pre-construction sale, and you know for sure that the value is increasing 10% in, let's say, 30 days or so. I'm just saying, for example, a condo at this pre-construction price is being sold for 120 or so, and then you know that pretty soon it'll be 130. In fact, it has been. Can you buy those units as an option? Keep them, for what you have a contract with the people or the developer or the builder, and before you close on your first closing with the people, turn around and sell it to somebody else, to another investor at a profit?
Well, certainly you can. From a tax standpoint, there's no problem with that. The profit's going to be a short-term gain to you. It could be ordinary income. If you do this enough, you could be considered a dealer in it, in which case it would be ordinary income. But one thing to watch out for is that many of the contracts for the purchase of the condos have a provision that make it unassignable, so that the even though you buy it, you have a contract for the purchase of the condo. Some of those have prohibitions against being able to resell it prior to the completion and closing on the property. I looked at one not long ago where exactly your situation that you've described was occurring. The property had gone up in value. They were interested in selling their condo before the building was even done, and the contract didn't permit it. So you need
right.
to watch out for the contract.
Sure. And, this is here a situation. You will only sign a contract once you have a sales contract with the people. Number two, you also have full covenants and agreements being given to you, then only. So it will be subject to or contingent upon, whatever approval of your attorney or accountant and so on. And we will go for and look for those clauses. If they are there, then you're not interested. If they are not there for any reason, then you move forward.
Right.
Because right now, amendment of purchase doesn't mean anything. It's a piece of paper, 8.5 by 14. So it's really not a contract. But if they are building and so on, till they give you a contract, at that time, you look at every clause and see if it's in your favor.
That's right.
So that can be done.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana. Line 1. Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi. I have a question about tuition and fees, and this is the situation. I graduated with a degree last May, but then there was a and for that I had a graduate assistantship which paid most of my tuition. So I didn't have much that I could claim in terms of dollars. But then in the fall, there was a class that really would be very helpful for me professionally, and I took the class and paid tuition out of pocket, which was considerably more. Can I claim that on my income tax?
Well, the question really is that when you say claim it, there's a couple of possibilities,
ways, yeah.
either as a lifetime learning credit
mm-hmm.
or as a tuition and fee deduction, either one. And the answer is yes. You
don't have to be have it be part of a degree program?
No,
to claim it.
No. Okay. Lifetime learning credit, I mean, I could go out to Parkland and take a class in photography, and that would qualify for the lifetime learning credit.
Oh, great. That's fine. The only trouble then is, the university provided me with a 1098-T form,
mm-hmm.
which listed my qualified tuition payment and did not include the course that I took postgraduate.
Hmm.
Can I just use cancel check to...
Yeah, just use the amount that you actually paid.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Very welcome. We probably could take one more call this afternoon, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The federal tax law on estates, I understand that no federal tax now on estates worth up to $2 million, but is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But now the states are not, all of the states are not up
yes.
to snuff or in sync it's, with it's, that. Where is Illinois?
Well, it's called decoupling, and
okay.
It traditionally, prior to the increases and scheduled increases in the federal estate tax exemption, states traditionally followed federal rules. But as the federal government raises the amount that is not subject to federal estate tax, it's currently $2 million, it's scheduled to go up to $3.5 million in a few years, states began saying, wait a second, we can't give up that revenue stream. It's, if you guys want to do it, that's fine, but don't take it out of our pocket. Illinois is currently at $2 million, the same as the IRS exemption equivalent amount. However, when the IRS amount increases to the $3.5 million, Illinois is going to remain at $2 million under current law. Now, this is all subject to change, but at that point, a taxpayer that, let's say, has a $3 million estate would not have any federal estate tax liability, but they may very well have estate tax liability on a $1 million Illinois estate,
okay.
The $1 million excess over the $2 million exemption amount.
Something
so
to keep
now,
in mind.
Some states, and this is important to check state to state, because there are states that stayed at a $1 million level that even today have this decoupling going into effect, so that you might have an estate of $2 million or less, which is not subject to any federal tax. You may still have a state tax, a state estate tax liability. Say that three or four times quickly.
I'm not going there.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else we might want to mention before we wrap up?
If you haven't started working on your tax return, get started now.
Yeah, either that or get that and, extension.
Yeah, and there are lots and lots of resources on the web these days. I occasionally will get phone calls from people that will say, gee, I need a particular tax form. Those forms are readily available along with their instructions on the web. If you don't want to go to the IRS.gov website and wade your way through that, just, you know, use a search engine, use Google and put, you know, IRS form 1040, and you'll find lots and lots of links to it. So that information is readily available out there.
Yeah. Can you put in a sentence, a question, a query in English and have an answer come back?
At the IRS.gov site,
yeah.
I don't believe they have a that type of query function.
Well, they do have a frequently asked questions section
that
you can use. And there's one for individuals, one for businesses. So depending on what you're looking for, you can sometimes get an answer that way.
Yeah, okay. So if there are folks out there listening to us this afternoon and they couldn't get to a phone and call us this afternoon, but they've got a question, maybe they can try that thing.
Exactly.
I always
hate to see really nice weather leading up to April 15th because it means that people are going to go out and enjoy the wonderful weather instead of getting their tax return done.
Well, I guess on Sunday it's not going to be such a nice day.
Okay.
So there you go. Increasing cloudiness with showers and thunderstorms.
Work on your tax
return.
We'll
get to work on Sunday. And our thanks very much to you, Marty and John.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Marty Burdick and John Breen are with RSM McGladrey Incorporated. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Thursday afternoon, futures finish the day like this in the May wheat pit, that is, up 2 3/4 today. 345 3/4, the high, the low price there at $3.42 a bushel. Settlement price at 344.5, they were up 2 3/4 on the day. July wheat in Chicago, 358, the high, the low at 54.25. Settlement price at 357.25, and they were up 2 3/4. September futures finished 3 higher at 368.5, with high at 69 and a low at 65.75. And the December contract, 384, the high, the low at 380.75. Settlement price at 383.5, and they were up 3 3/4 on the day. From the corn pit, the nearby May contract, 228, the high, the low at 50, or at 225.25. Settlement price at 227 and three quarters. They were up 3.5 for the day. July futures 239, the high, the low at 36. Settlement price at 38 and three quarters, up 3.25. And September futures in the corn pit, 248 and a quarter, the high, the low at 45.5. Settlement price at $2.48 a bushel, up 3.5. December contract in the corn pit, your harvest month, 260 and a quarter, the high, the low at 57.5. Settlement price at $2.60 even. They were up 3.25 for the day. The March futures 270, the high, the low at 66. Settlement price at 68 and three quarters, up 3.5. And the May corn, 274, the high, the low at 70. Settlement price at $2.73.5 for May 2007 corn. They finished 4 cents a bushel higher for the day. Oat pit now, May contract at 172 and a quarter, settlement price up a penny with a high of 73 and a low at 69.5. And July futures at $1.75. We're up a half cent a bushel for the day. Soy complex, nearby May bean futures, 589, the high, the low at 84.5. Settlement price at $5.87 and three quarters, up 5.25. In the July, 601 and a quarter, the high, low at 596.5. Settlement price at $6 and a penny, up a 5.75 for the day. August contract, 606, the high, the low at 602. Settlement price at 605 and three quarters. They were up 6.25 for the day as they rallied above $6. September futures, 609, the high, low at 605.5. Settlement price there at 608.5, up 5.25. In the November beans, this is your harvest month, 616.5, the high, the low at 611. Settlement price at 615.5, up 5.25. January futures were up 4 cents today.